You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In American racial history, there are two Supreme Court decisions that are widely viewed as cementing racial inequality and injustice into our society. The pre-Civil War Dred Scott decision, which held that blacks, whether slave or free, could never be citizens, and slavery couldn't be regulated by the federal government, and Plessy versus Ferguson, which is widely viewed as providing for separate but equal accommodations for African American, which led to complete segregation in the South and in certain areas throughout the country. Actually, the latter decision never mentions separate but equal. By 1896, segregation was already codified by custom and increasingly by law in the South. In fact, the case was brought by the Creole community in New Orleans to try to overturn existing segregated regulations for rail travel. My guest today says rail travel was a frequent flashpoint for racial separation, going back to the 1830s in New England, and that's where his history of the Plessy decision begins. Washington Post senior editor Steve Luxenberg tells the story of Plessy versus Ferguson in his book Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. In it, he tells the story of the principal figures. The man behind the lawsuit, Louis Martinet, a lawyer and crusading newspaper editor in New Orleans. Albion Tourge, Homer Plessy's attorney, the country's best-known white advocate for civil rights. And the Supreme Court justices who wrote the decisions. Henry Billings Brown from the North, whose majority ruling endorsed separation, and John Marshall Harlan from a family of slave owners in Kentucky, the case's only dissenter. Steve Luxenberg, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Tell us why you decided to write about the story of Plessy versus Ferguson today. What compelled you to research this story?
Well, first, let's be clear. Plessy versus Ferguson is an 1896 Supreme Court case in which the court sanctioned separate but equal. It's sort of synonymous with that phrase, although those words don't appear in the decision. And I was motivated to go into this case as an effort to explore the roots of racial separation in the 19th century, because I was looking at our conversation today in which race persists as part of our national conversation. I think we spent a lot of time talking about it and a lot of time avoiding talking about it. And I wanted to understand where the roots of this conversation began.
To you, is this decision the roots?
The decision itself is not the root. As we know, the framers of the Constitution embedded race right into that document in 1789 by accepting slavery as part of the country's economic system, with the infamous three-fifths of a person being allowed to be used as political apportionment in the South, which gave the South more representation. But that conversation that we have, 200-plus years later, we're still talking about race. Recent news has proven that.
Yes.
And so I think this book is quite timely.
When we think of Plessy, when we think of it at all, for people in the legal community and those who are casually acquainted with the legals, this decision that cemented segregation as the law of the land at the end of the 19th century. And I think oftentimes as the last steps by segregationists to make that the case. But that's not the case, is it?
No, it really isn't the case. And in fact, the Supreme Court ruling didn't make it the law of the entire land. It merely said that it was okay for Louisiana to pass this separate railroad car act in 1890, and it was decided as a matter of states' rights to use their, quote, police powers to preserve order and on railroad trains. But it spread, of course. Other states were doing that at the same time. There was already a separate railroad car act in Mississippi and Florida. There soon were others throughout the South. But these were the first time that there were laws. The custom of separating white and black passengers on railroad trains actually begins before the Civil War in Massachusetts.
Yes.
At the dawn of the railroad age in the late 1830s, there were three railroad companies in Massachusetts out of the eight that were operating that chose to use separate cars for a time. They eventually went away. But that's where the birth of separation on public accommodation begins.
And that story is where your story begins, 1830s Massachusetts, which might surprise people writing about Plessy versus Ferguson, that the story actually begins there. Was this the first instance you could find of a railroad discriminating by race to separate the races? And this is really at the birth of passenger railroads.
It was the first instance of it. And interestingly enough, I also found with the marvelous help of digital digging in the 21st century, you know, on the internet, that the first use of the term Jim Crow car, which I associate, and I think most people would, with the 20th century, separate waiting rooms, separate bathrooms, separate water fountains, the first use of Jim Crow to apply to a railroad car is in the Salem Gazette, October 12, 1838, in writing about an incident that happened on the Boston to Salem run.
We assume that was commonly in use if the newspaper is using it at that point, right?
I can't say for sure, but yeah. It was interesting to me in reading it. It was not even a first reference. They didn't define Jim Crow car. They just used it as if its readers and the train crew would have been using it in common language, yes.
So we think of Jim Crow as being a term of the South, and again, a term of the early 20th century when everything was separate, from drinking fountains to accommodations, waiting for a train, as well as riding on a train, to virtually every facet of life. Where did the word come from?
My best educated, researched guess is that the existence of the Jim Crow minstrel show in blackface, white entertainers in blackface, during the 1830s, there was one entertainer whose name was Thomas Dartmouth Rice, was so popular. You know, he had this line in his show, every time I jumped Jim Crow became, you know, the newspaper editors were looking for a shorthand to describe politicians who would flip-flop in those days, and they used the term Jim Crow to apply to that. So the phrase had already migrated from the stage into common language in other ways. And so my best guess is that that's why they began to call the car the Jim Crow car, but they had other names for it. They called it the dirt car. They called it the refuse, as in trash car. These were obviously offensive terms for the car. And the abolitionists in Massachusetts seized on this issue because they were riding these trains and they were having confrontations with the conductors as they rode in pairs of white and black abolitionists. They seized on this issue and said they wanted to consign the dirt car to the, quote, receptacle of forgotten barbarisms. That's what they wrote in the Liberator newspaper.
In fact, you find a reference to a very young Frederick Douglass being among the first black abolitionists that were ejected from a white-only car.
Douglass had fled from his enslaved condition in Maryland and gone to Massachusetts. He had been there a couple of years, and he was the youngest, 23, 24 years old, youngest agent of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. And he was on the train from Boston to Salem frequently, because the abolitionists loved the trains. They had been going to night meetings on horseback. So the trains were a great thing. And they had conductors saying, well, you know, sir, you need to go to the refuse car. And he refused. And he describes in his memoir holding on to the seat, gripping the seat so tightly that he ripped it off of its bolts as six men ousted him from the car.
And what became apparent, I guess, from this early research is this was a common way of fighting the customs. And in this case, this wasn't governmental law. This was a railroad policy to separate the races. So railroads became this early vehicle of fighting custom segregation as well as policies of businesses and private institutions to segregate.
That's right. And think about it. You know, there's nothing like a railroad car to throw humanity together. This was a new thing. The idea, the question was, where do I sit? Because before that, these stagecoaches that people used were too small and they rarely had mixed passengers. But a railroad car suddenly opened up this question. And remember, as I said earlier, only three of the eight lines in Massachusetts, railroad lines, used separate cars. And as the abolitionists pressed their campaign, they sent these petitions to the Massachusetts legislature. I went to the Massachusetts State Archives and had them unfold one of these petitions that had more than 1,000 signatures opposing separation. I measured it. It was 14 feet long. And I didn't want to refold it, I'll tell you. I was glad they did. But they went to the legislature, and there was a lively debate about banning these separate cars. And the son and grandson of two U.S. presidents, Charles Francis Adams, was reluctant. He was one of the leaders of the ban on the ban, but he was reluctant to make a corporation do something according to state law. So he came up with an artful dodge. The railroads kind of folded their tents, banned the separate cars themselves voluntarily, and there was no law that required them to do so. So think about how our jurisprudence might have changed had the Massachusetts legislature decided to intervene and say what a corporation ought to do. Maybe that would have changed things today.
Yes, very, in a lot of different ways, indeed. I found some of the interesting things you found in this early incident of public segregation really interesting. There was like a traveler guide. This was like the Green Book for travelers in the 1830s, and it really described the various railroad lines and who was accommodating and who was less than accommodating for people of color.
Well, this was an interesting thing. The Liberator newspaper, you're referring to the Traveler's Directory that appeared there, was the editor was William Lloyd Garrison, who, for people who know about abolition, he's the leader. He's the famous abolitionist. The man is a radical. He burns the Constitution in 1854 because he's so frustrated with the fact that it allows for a Fugitive Slave Act and the North's cooperation in returning escaped slaves to the South. He comes up with this idea of taking the railroad schedules that the railroads were sending as an advertisement to the newspaper and annotating them with these little bon mots. So on the ones that were not separating passengers, he would say things like, rights respected. But on the Eastern Railroad between Boston and Salem, he said, an odious enforcement of separation with a bullying propensity, using the language of the day. And he was having a great deal of fun with this, although it was obviously serious business.
My guest today is Steve Luxenberg. He is a senior editor at the Washington Post and the author of the new book, Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, if we can fast forward a little bit to the immediate post-war era after the Civil War, the aftermath brought three post-war constitutional amendments and Reconstruction, the 13th, 14th, and 15th. And during that next first decade of Reconstruction after the war, the Southern states were forced to make accommodations for people of color in the South. You saw several men, black men, go to Congress. Louisiana, the birthplace of Plessy v. Ferguson, enacted a public accommodations law guaranteeing equal access. But with the end of Reconstruction, basically the South started imposing segregation through every means available. And your story of Separate tells the story of what happened with Plessy v. Ferguson. As we were talking earlier, I said most people think of Plessy being an attempt by segregationists to create this separate but equal that is not mentioned in the decision, but is what we think comes out of Plessy v. Ferguson. But in fact, it was brought by three people of color of Louisiana trying to end segregation. That was surprising in and of itself, I think.
Louisiana group, which was the wealthy, educated professionals from the mixed-race community there, they had been free since before the American takeover, their ancestors, obviously. And the American takeover of Louisiana was 1803, so by almost 100 years later, they were a frustrated, unhappy group. And they decided that they were not going to stand by while this 1890 law requiring the separation on railroads operating in the state of Louisiana, they were not going to allow it to take place without a fight. So they brought this lawsuit. It was an arranged arrest. Homer Plessy was a volunteer, 29 years old, married, living in the mixed-race community of Faubourg Treme. And the railroad was in on the arrest because they had an economic stake. You know, why run a separate railroad car if it's half empty? So they didn't want to run extra cars. And the arrest took place in June of 1892. You know, it went as planned. You know, he boarded the train, bought a ticket, and by nightfall he was in jail where the committee wanted him to be temporarily so that they could start the case.
Interesting. And you've described the whole history of what is known as les gens de couleur libre, the free people of color. They'd been promised rights over and over since the takeover by Americans in 1803. Jackson, when he utilizes their forces in combat to save New Orleans during the War of 1812, makes promises. They've been promised freedoms for a number of years, and yet they existed on this sort of tenuous ground. They weren't subject to slavery, but they weren't free men either.
I describe them in the book as a kind of sandwiched layer between the white population and the enslaved population. Some of them owned slaves themselves. This is a route to economic wealth, and so some of them participated in it. But yes, they were trying to get their rights. And they would do it at various moments. The promise from Jackson was well remembered by this group of French-speaking Creoles. And they, in the 1860s, during the Civil War, New Orleans was a key city because it was on the Mississippi River. And it was occupied by the federal troops, by the U.S. Army, right away. They had it by 1862. And it was under Union authority. So there was a lot of opportunity to have political discussions. And this mixed-race group not only would have meetings in New Orleans, but eventually sent a delegation to Lincoln in Washington to meet with him to plead their case. And Lincoln, who had been consistent throughout the war in saying that he was only going to free the enslaved people for military purposes, he saw this as an opportunity on the one hand, but he also didn't want to be inconsistent. So he said to them, I'm sympathetic to your cause, but this is a political decision that has to wait for the end of the war. And they went home sorely disappointed.
So take us back up to 1892. The effort is made to challenge this state law, the Separate Car Act from 1890. And the forces are led by, there are four narratives that you tell in this story. One is Louis Martinet, or Martinet, a lawyer, a newspaper editor. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he's a fascinating guy. His family is not born in New Orleans, but he moves there as a young man, goes to university there for people of color. Like a lot of people, he didn't get a law degree, but he read the law at the university and then got a law degree by attaching himself to other law firms. And by 1890, he's got a lot of irons in the fire. He's a notary public, which is a major thing in New Orleans, a little bit more in that system of government. He's running the newspaper. He's an activist. And he's frustrated and he's unhappy. When he goes to Chicago to study medicine, he also becomes a doctor later on, he sees how he's not fooled by the North. He realizes that the North has its own racist past, but he sees that freedoms are there that he doesn't feel in New Orleans, even though he's fair-skinned and can pass for white and often does. So he and the lawyer for the committee is a northerner named Albion Turgay, and they have a lively correspondence that survives and I make liberal use of in writing the book. And he tells Turgay how frustrated he is to be going back to New Orleans in 1893 from Chicago where he was studying because he feels like he's going back to a stifling environment and that his family should have a better life than that. The letters are quite poignant. He attends the famous Chicago World's Fair in 1893, and he sees so little about the history of the African-American population there that he says in his letter, I wish the whole enterprise, meaning the fair, I wish the whole enterprise would just sink into Lake Michigan and I would be happy.
So why did they choose this particular place for their test case of everywhere in the South they could have done this? Because, as you mentioned, there were laws like this other places in the South already. Was there something special about New Orleans or about this particular case they felt like they had the best chance of success? Because really, in the South, by this point, segregation is de facto, it's completed.
Well, it's not quite reached completion. Uh-huh. It's in its earliest stages of these laws. As you pointed out, they were customs before that. The laws are coming in the 1880s, late 1880s, first in Florida, then in Mississippi, then in Louisiana. Well, I think they chose it because they lived there. I mean, this was happening to them every day. And they had plans, you can see this in Martinet's newspaper articles, they had plans to go elsewhere in the South once they, you know, if they weren't successful in New Orleans. But it was easiest for them to bring the case in New Orleans. It was expensive. They were raising money. I don't think they could have possibly afforded to do it elsewhere. And they had no allies elsewhere. And they knew the law in Louisiana. So it made sense for them to bring it there. And also, they really thought they had a good chance because, you know, New Orleans is unlike any other place in the South in this time period, and I would say still. It's not like Atlanta or Charleston or Savannah. It has this somewhat wealthy, somewhat educated, mixed-race group of Creoles, and they think that it's very difficult to tell the race of a lot of the people in New Orleans because they have this mixed-race background. And the law doesn't say anything about what the definition of color is. It doesn't define a black person or a white person. And so the lawyers argued that there was no way that a conductor moving down the aisles in a train in Louisiana could possibly sort out the passengers. And so the law was unenforceable. That's the argument they made. It didn't stick at the Supreme Court, but that's the one that they were banking on. And that's why they asked Homer Plessy to be a volunteer, because he was, as I write in the book, he was fair-skinned enough to cause confusion.
Interesting. Now, you tell the story of the two Supreme Court justices that were at the heart of the case, the one who wrote the majority ruling and the only dissenter in the 7-1 decision that sort of cemented segregation legally in the United States. If you read their bios, as you read in the book, if you didn't know the story, you would say, okay, the one who wrote the majority ruling probably was the dissenter, and the one that was the dissenter was probably the person who wrote the majority ruling. This is Henry Billing Browns from New England and Michigan, and John Marshall Harlan of Kentucky. Tell us about these two.
Yeah, I was fascinated by their evolution. Like you, I would have thought that they would have ended up on the opposite sides of the case. But Brown had never really visited the South. He didn't have a feel for what it was like. He didn't fight in the Civil War. He hired a substitute, which was a common thing to do. Many people did so. He liked to go to Europe. He went to Europe a dozen times. And as I write in the book, he knew more about London, Paris, and Rome than he knew about Atlanta, Savannah, or New Orleans.
Wow.
Harlan, on the other hand, not only did he grow up in Kentucky, he came from a slaveholding family. When his father died in 1862, he inherited those slaves. And he raises a Union regiment in 1861 to preserve the Union. He's the colonel, leader of these men. And he says he will fight for the Union, but he will not fight to end slavery. This is his position. In 1859, when he's 25 years old and a year before the Civil War, he runs as a pro-slavery candidate for Congress. So this is not somebody who is likely to come out as the dissenter in this case, but he undergoes this remarkable evolution after the war. He renounces his pro-slavery views. He says he was wrong. And by 1877, when he's nominated to the Supreme Court, this past comes back to haunt him because the Republicans, which is the party of anti-slavery, they're mad at President Hayes for nominating Harlan, saying, this is the best guy you can find for this job. Does that sound familiar?
Yes.
And so they don't like it, but he makes it, gets nominated, gets approved, and he starts serving on the court, and he becomes the clarion voice for civil rights in the United States in the cases that come before the court, first in 1883, then in 1889, then in 1896.
And not only did Harlan run as a pro-slavery candidate, he was also, he sort of banked on his political power on the rise of the Know-Nothings, which were even worse. They were anti-immigrant. They didn't want to have anything to do with slavery, anti-slavery efforts. They just said, leave everything alone. This guy comes from not a good place in the political sphere of America in the 1850s, and yet he has this remarkable evolution. What was at the heart of it, do you think?
Kentucky politics in the 1850s, which I try to recreate, was a wild and woolly place. If you were a Whig, which is what he was, let's be clear, his father was the Whig, and John was just following in his father's footsteps. He's a young man. But the Whigs are lost in Kentucky in the 1850s. Henry Clay, the most important Whig of all in Kentucky, had run for president, nearly made it. By the time of his death, the Whig Party is kind of on the way out, and it's replaced by the Republicans, the anti-slavery party that's founded in the North. But the Republicans can't get a foothold in Kentucky because they're just too radical for Kentucky. So he and his father, for a number of years, I'm talking about a decade, are kind of a part of what's called the opposition, which is a nothing party, right? It doesn't have a name even. It's just the opposition. The opposition to what? Well, it's the opposition to the Democrats. They can't be Democrats. The Democrats aren't their cup of tea. And so after the war, John's got a choice. He either joins the Republican or he joins the Democrats. And he kind of has a dalliance with the Democrats for a while, but he can't stomach it, and he joins the Republican Party. And I think that one of the most critical parts of this was his relationship with Benjamin Bristow, a Republican in Kentucky who had been prosecuting civil rights cases in the aftermath of the Civil War and had gone to Washington to become first Solicitor General and then Secretary of the Treasury. They had been law partners for a time, and I think Bristow had a huge influence on Harlan. And Harlan becomes comfortable with being a Republican, and he thinks about what the past has been like, and he really believes in the Union. I think he was truly pro-slavery, but I also think he was truly pro-Union.
Well, in the decision, when it finally comes to the Supreme Court, the court rules 7-1 that the Louisiana legislature could enact a separate car law. Brown writes the majority opinion. As you mentioned, the separate but equal doesn't appear in the majority's ruling, but that's sort of how the nation takes it. Harlan dissents. What was Harlan's dissent on the matter?
Well, you know, when he dissented in an earlier civil rights case in 1883, newspapers around the country were waiting for his dissent, and they printed, many of them printed it in full. In 1896, his Plessy decision was not printed in full anywhere. So by 1896, the country had become accustomed to the Supreme Court ruling in this narrow way on civil rights cases. The ruling in Plessy was an expected one. It would have been a total surprise that they ruled any other way. But and Harlan had become the expected dissenter by this point. The case revolved in the opinion of the Plessy lawyers around the 14th Amendment and its clause protecting whites and blacks equally, the Equal Protection Clause. But the majority did not buy that in that case or in the earlier ones. It had a very narrow interpretation of the 14th Amendment and said that this is merely a case of Louisiana's police powers to preserve law and order. And that's the way we're deciding this, as a states' rights case. Harlan totally accepted the 14th Amendment idea. He not only accepted that, he accepted the 13th Amendment argument that Turgay and his team had thrown at the court. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery, but it also made unconstitutional any, quote, badge of servitude. And Turgay's argument was that putting someone in a separate railroad car because of their color was kind of stamping them with a badge of inferiority. The majority didn't buy that. They specifically rebuked him for using the 13th Amendment, saying, I don't understand why you're relying on this amendment that really is about slavery. But Harlan embraced it. He embraced not only the 13th, but he embraced the 14th. And he said in his decision that this was a shameful day for the court and that this decision would be regarded in history as bad as the Dred Scott decision before the Civil War, which declared that blacks could not be citizens. And obviously, Harlan was the one who endures in history. He's been proven right, and Henry Billings Brown has been proven wrong.
And you said at the time, by this point, the reporters, and this was not a major covered case. This was, as you said, it was expected to go the way of Ferguson in this case, and segregation would be allowed. It was not really covered much. It only becomes important
there were some
in hindsight.
Newspapers that made a headline out of it.
Yeah,
I'm pleased to say that my newspaper, the Washington Post, was one of them, although it gave short shrift to the oral arguments. But many newspapers didn't even put it in the headline or the first paragraph. There were other cases that the courts released that day, and they gave attention to some of those other cases. And you said before that, you know, it became a turning point, and we now recognize it to be one, but it wasn't recognized right away because there needed to be other cases that came before the Supreme Court in which Plessy was cited as a precedent, and there needed to be the spread of these separate car laws and other separation in public accommodations to other states before it became apparent to the country that Plessy was where it started because it didn't do something. It didn't stop it. And by, I think, the 1940s and certainly the 1950s in Brown versus Board of Education, when the court reverses itself and renounces Plessy, by then it had become recognized that Plessy was this turning point, but it wasn't right away.
Interesting. Well, it's a fascinating book. The name of the book is Separate. Steve, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Steve Luxenburg is a senior editor at the Washington Post. His new book is titled Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. It's published by Norton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.